こんにちは and welcome back to Japan Edge for all things Japan. This channel brings you the latest insights and stories straight from the heart of Tokyo. This podcast is intended for those of you interested in Japan but don't know much about the country, and for those of you looking for insights beyond what the typical guidebooks would offer you. I'll be sharing with you some of the topics that the local Japanese are tuning into recently, and will also give you my personal take on some of our cultural aspects. So, I hope you'll enjoy today's episode. I want to talk about a cultural aspect of Japan today. Today's topic, trends, fanaticism, and their implications. There is a number of academic research by multiple scholars on Japanese obsession with trends. They analyze from cultural and social economic contexts. But even just by seeing people's behaviors here in Tokyo, you could see to a certain extent that Japanese show strong tendency of following fads and trends to a bit of an extreme. This is actually one of the things I always feel whenever I come back to Japan from my time abroad. Let's start off on a light tone. Take fashion, for example. If you go to a shopping mall, you would notice that almost all of the fashion stores carry pretty much the same things. There is a shopping mall called Lumine in Shinjuku, and the tenant shops in Lumine are predominantly targeting women. Now, you will be able to see what's trending in fashion, in accessories, in cosmetics, just by being in this one shopping mall for maybe 15 minutes, because almost all stores carry similar looking items. Then you would realize that girls and women actually are dressed pretty much in the same style, with, of course, some tweakings here and there. But they're the looks that are recommended by the retailers and pushed by the media. Now, my take is that the power of the media is much stronger here than anywhere else in the world. Maybe one evidence of this is that Japan is one of the few countries where print fashion magazines still hold their prominence. Now, according to Japan Media Publishing Association, there are 21 active women's magazines targeting what they call the young adult segment, basically the Gen Zs, and 12 magazines for the middle-aged women category, consisting of women in their late 30s and 40s. Now, each women's fashion magazine is geared towards a specific target segment, divided very strategically to associate with certain women's lifestyles. Now, what's interesting is that most of these magazines are very, very practical. They're basically how-to books on what to wear, how the top and bottom coordination should be, what to eat, and so forth. And it's even typical to see pages suggesting what to wear each day from Monday to Sunday, offering various scenarios and what to wear on certain occasions. Now, I want to share with you some of the academic views that attempt to explain this Japanese tendency. One is the social conformity and collectivism. Japanese society places a strong emphasis on conformity and group harmony, and this has been true for centuries, basically. This is deeply rooted throughout our education system, from nursery up to college, and elementary schools especially put heavy emphasis on conformity, with rigid rules defining proper daily behaviors. So, in essence, we are brought to adhere to group norms. Of course, the criticism that this kills individuality is granted, and personally, I think that's true. But, on the other hand, the Japanese education system and the enforcement of conformity is, to some extent, what has allowed this country to be organized as a society. Extremely safe, almost crime-free, everything in nice orders, clean basically everywhere. Because you would not want to stand out, you obviously avoid doing something out of the ordinary. So of course, you would wait in line patiently at the train platform or go down the stairs in line so not to disrupt the flow, etc. And you know, it does take courage to do something different. And the silent pressure of being the same or not standing out is quite strong here in Japan. So going back to the topic of following what the magazines tell you, it's actually comforting for many women to know that you are not going to be an outlier and stand out. Conformity could serve as a comfort rather than a negative pressure. Now, another academic explanation relates to business, that is, analysis on consumerism in Japan. Japan has a consumer culture with a constant influx of new products and trends, mostly very strategically crafted, orchestrated by the mega retailers, manufacturers, and the media. Business environment has been changing in recent years, so it's not as bad as before, but still, even today, business is pretty much controlled by the dominant players. When it comes to fashion, for example, there are a couple of trading companies that control the imports of international brands, and their strong relationship with the retailers allow them to dominate the shelves. Their strong ties with the media allows them to create the kind of hype that they want. So basically, they actually have the value chain under their control. They know exactly what they're doing, and the Japanese consumers fall into their scheme. Another example of an industry that's influenced greatly by the media is food, especially sweets. The sweets industry is pretty big in Japan. According to Yano Economic Research Institute, the sweets industry, which covers both Japanese and Western style sweets and ice cream, is about a $13.5 billion industry. Now, this industry can be roughly broken down into two segments. One, the inexpensive, convenience store-driven sweets market, and the other, high-end premium sweets, driven primarily by the department stores and the independent famous pastry shops in the affluent residential areas. Now, in any case, the media and the marketers are heavily involved in shaping this industry. Trends of sweets and breads have always been one of the hottest topics in Japan, and the trend could rise all of a sudden from a small shop that posted some very compelling photogenic pictures of their sweets, which then turns viral all of a sudden and goes full force with the big corporate media picking it up on a national level. Now, Japan is a small country, so one big effort could move the sentiment of the entire country. Let me share a couple of examples of items that experienced a dramatic rise and subsequent fall in recent years. First up, tapioca, those beloved bubbles. Tapioca bubble drinks began capturing attention in late 2018, maintaining their allure for about 2 years before fading by mid-2020. Another similar example is premium white bread. In 2019, the hype for premium white bread started as a couple of independent bakeries started introducing loaves made with high-quality ingredients. Now, you may be surprised to hear this, but bread, particularly toast, is a staple breakfast choice for many Japanese people, and white bread holds a significant place in our daily lives. Prior to 2019, white bread was merely food for breakfast to be toasted and eaten with butter and jam. It was something you buy in a supermarket. The landscape, however, shifted with the rise of independent bakeries and pastry shops introducing premium white bread variations. Although the premium white bread market still exists today, the initial excitement clearly started to fade away by 2023. The aftermath of the tapioca and premium white bread boom is unfortunate and honestly quite disturbing to me. Because the trend lasted over a year, many inexperienced individuals were lured into these businesses, believing that they were great opportunities. But what was the reality? They vanished as quickly as the booms arrived, leaving many mom-and-pop shops in serious debt. You know, I vividly recall watching evening news segments featuring business consultants across Japan hosting seminars on opening tapioca stands. The participants seemed happy, voicing their interest, citing tapioca's popularity and the perceived ease of starting such a venture, as long as you had the right equipment. Watching these clips left me feeling really uneasy. I was wondering whether these aspiring people truly understood the concept of return on investment. I mean, selling a plastic cup of bubble tea leaves only minimal profit margins, so it would be essential to operate in high traffic areas to cover upfront costs such as equipment purchases and store renovations, not to mention ongoing expenses like rent. What upsets me the most is the fact that there was a total absence of any cautionary voices in the society. No one bothered to challenge the prevailing optimism surrounding these ventures. Skepticism was taboo in the face of what was deemed a star, adorned by the entire society. That was the prevailing sentiment during those times. The fate of premium white bread was very similar to that of tapioca, but with much more dire consequences. Unlike the relatively straightforward setup of tapioca stands, many individual shops seeking to join the premium white bread fortune entered franchise agreement with the brands. This was because the essence of the business lay in the exclusive ingredients and baking techniques, accessible only through franchising. But obviously, access to these essential components didn't come cheap. Franchisees were required to make significant upfront payments for ingredients, equipment, training, and promotional materials, all while being subject to ongoing royalty fees and operational costs. The financial equation never added up, even at the height of the hype. So when the boom waned, the fallout was catastrophic. Franchisees found themselves trapped in agreement that couldn't be terminated without hefty penalties. And what really upsets me is the fact that this premium white bread company achieved rapid expansion through aggressive franchising. By 2019, this leading brand boasted over 240 nationwide outlets, but they were predominantly franchised. Now, more and more franchisees are beginning to speak out, sharing their stories. And it was reported that over 90% of these franchisees suffered staggering losses, some exceeding 10 million yen, which is approximately $70,000 per month. Now, yes, the franchisees should have known better. And that's true. But at the same time, you have to wonder whether they were well informed about what they were getting into. My main concern lies in the power of national level fads and hype engineered by a selected few. Too often, this society falls into herd mentality without question. Having lived in several countries as outside of Japan, I know that this happens everywhere in the world, but in my view, it's a bit too extreme here in Japan. And this kind of social characteristics gives some people great advantage. As a person with an MBA background and experience in equity and management consulting, it actually infuriates me to witness so-called consultants preaching get-rich-quick schemes without providing the full picture, including the risks. And the victims are often the same. Those easily swayed by mass perception. And I just cannot help but attribute a portion of the blame to the nature of hype perpetuated by, really, the society as a whole. In a culture where conformity often deters questioning norms, the Japanese tendency to follow perceived mass opinion can be concerning. The majority consensus, unquestioned and unchallenged, can blind us to reality. It's a phenomenon that is not without precedent in our history. We've tragically experienced the consequences of blind belief before, if you know what I'm talking about. Wrapping up today's episode, I hope our discussion has offered you fresh insights into Japanese culture and behavior. It's not about defining what's right or wrong, but rather about embracing the importance of exploring issues from multiple angles. This was only my third podcast episode, but I hope to continue bringing you stories from Japan that are often not covered beyond our borders, and offering diverse perspectives for a deeper understanding of this country. Thank you for tuning in, and I look forward to sharing more with you in future episodes. Until then, またね。さよなら。